I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Moorhead's monthly Current Science Forum series presents expert speakers and lively discussions of today's science headlines. Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center is online at moorheadplanetarium.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is a gentleman who has worked tirelessly for decades to help reduce health disparities in the United States. And we are going to spend this hour talking about his fascinating career and many of the current issues in minority health, public health, and social justice. Dr. William Carter Jenkins is an epidemiologist and biostatistician by trade and training. Until recently, he was resident epidemiologist and a senior scholar at the UNC Institute of African American Research, and he is co-director of the Minority Health Project within the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. Prior to joining UNC, Bill served for two decades as supervisory epidemiologist in the National Center for HIV, STD, and TB Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, better known as the CDC, in Atlanta. And he also managed its Minority Health Activities Program and managed the Participant Health Benefits Program, which assures medical services to the survivors of the Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in the Negro male, that notorious study which we will certainly be talking about. Bill served as an expert in minority issues in disease transmission as chief of the Research and Evaluation Statistics Section in the Division of Sexually Transmitted Diseases Prevention and as manager of the National Minority Organization's HIV Prevention Program. He was also a longtime faculty member at Morehouse College and at the Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta. Bill got his bachelor's degree in mathematics from Morehouse College, and he also holds a master's degree in biostatistics from Georgetown University. And he is a Tar Heel also, as he got his master's in public health and a PhD in epidemiology from UNC Chapel Hill. He was named a distinguished alumnus from UNC, a very great honor, in 2004. Bill, it is a real pleasure to welcome you to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you very much.
With all the credentials I just related, and I left a few important ones out even, I wanted to leave us a little time to talk after relating your resume. It's kind of hard to know where to dive in and begin our discussion. But in this case, I'd like to start the program with a guest's I usually ask my guests towards the end of the program, after we've kind of gone through their activities. But I want to kind of start at the beginning with you, and that is what led you into your particular lines of specialty, that is epidemiology and biostatistics.
Well, my family has been historically involved in social and health programs in Charleston, South Carolina, mm-hmm. for over 100 years, and there was a natural inclination towards health. My talents, gifts, allowed me to study mathematics. It was the one thing that I enjoyed. And so I initially combined the interest in mathematics and applying it to health issues and biostatistics, and then taking a course in biostatistics at Georgetown. I took my first epidemiology course and immediately fell in love with it, and mm-hmm. it's been that way ever since.
So you found your home.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Well, you know, I want to hear all about the pursuits that you've had in your career. But first, why don't we talk a little bit about the positions that you're doing right now? You've only been officially in Chapel Hill for a period of a couple of months at this point. So tell us what you're doing here at UNC.
Well, the most important activity right now is working with the Minority Health Project, and there are two activities that's going on. On this Friday, February 25th at the Friday Center, the Minority Student Caucus will be holding a conference, and it will focus on minority health issues, and you can find out about the conference by going to the UNC-EDU website and then search Minority Health Project, and it will give you links to the student conference, mm-hmm. As well as a video conference we're planning for June 7, and that would also focus on more on health disparities issues. And these two conferences have been active since I was a student at UNC. So the student conferences started 32 years ago when I was president or chair of the Black Student Caucus. Mm-hmm. And the video conference was started not too long thereafter.
I see. So I understand just for those interested, the title of this year's meeting is The Promise of Health Equity, Advancing the Discussion to Eliminate Disparities in the 21st Century.
Yes.
Sounds like there's going to be plenty to talk about.
Plenty to talk about, yes.
And that you were actually one of the founders of this series.
Yes.
Well, that's terrific. And yeah. It must be so neat to see it continuing on and thriving.
Absolutely.
Like
but the students today have taken it on much further than we did. They're far more organized, far brighter and more energetic, and so it's really going to be a wonderful conference.
Well, that's great. I'm sure it's going to be a big success. Mm-hmm. Bill, in researching for our discussion today, I got the impression overall that you are a very passionate individual who is totally committed to what you do. Is that a fair description? And if so, where does that fire come from?
Yeah, some people would describe me that way. My days of jumping on tables and screaming are long over, but in a more quiet way.
Feel free.
No, I think those days are long gone.
Okay.
But in a more quiet way, in a more persistent way, I have been committed to activities which focus on bringing young people into the field. Mm-hmm. We started an institute many years ago called the Public Health Sciences Institute, which trains initially African-American students in biostatistics and epidemiology. Now we train students from all underrepresented minorities there. We were able to start a master public health program at Morehouse School of Medicine, which was the first accredited MPH program at historically black colleges. And there are now 9 MPH programs at historically black colleges around the nation, primarily in the Southeast. And we've been passionate and consistent about carrying out those activities, as well as focusing on health disparities issues, particularly trying to develop communities in hopes of communities seeking the help of universities, but directing the research to solve the problems in their communities. So,
Well, as I mentioned in my introduction to you, you know, one of your great interests and lifelong career interests certainly has been working to help eradicate health disparities in our society. For the benefit of our listeners who may not actually be familiar with that concept, could you give us kind of a brief overview of health disparities and why they're so damaging?
Yes. Well, the first point I think it's important to make is that health disparities has been an issue since the beginning of our nation. That there have been some groups that have, because of the issues around oppression, segregation, discrimination, and so on, have not fared as well as others in our nation. And that difference in health outcome has been with us for a long time. If you look at infant mortality over the last century, what you'll find is that the infant mortality rate, which is the basic measure of community health, has gone down substantially over the last century. However, the health disparities, the rate, the comparison as of, say, infant mortality rate in the black community compared to the white community has not changed at all. That we have attempted to solve these problems, but we've attempted to solve them using the same approach that we tried in 1900, we're still primarily trying those same approaches today in 2000, and the result has been the same, that we haven't really reduced health disparities. So it's trying to understand what really causes health disparities and how do we try to focus on those factors to cause health disparities. Unfortunately, the factors which do not cause health disparities are factors that most people are interested in because they are focused on money, things like medicine, genetics, and so on. The money issues will push us to look to solve problems that are not even related to the problem, whereas the issues that do cause health disparities, things like socioeconomic status, culture, and discrimination, those are more difficult issues to tackle, and therefore people have not been willing to invest in those. And so it has been the persistence of this problem that has been a great concern to me, and the feeling that there's relatively little effort to solve the problems that actually cause health disparities. And we've got to somehow move the agenda towards those factors which actually cause health disparities.
Well, I know that you have said in some of your public speaking that estimated that the etiology of health disparities can be broken out to roughly 30% socioeconomic status, 30% racism, 30% culture, and only about 10% of medical care and genetics.
Yes.
But that's, as you just pointed out, that's where the majority of the money seems to be flowing. Do you see any trends in the right direction here? Because I know that the governmental agencies are paying more attention to social determinants, for example.
Yes. Well, we think the idea of focusing on community issues and social determinants of health have been around. We've been involved since organizing a small meeting in 1991 and have seen a substantial increase in work focusing on community issues, on social determinants of health, on the use of community participation in the process of research and in the process of developing interventions. As we've seen increases in that, we've seen that we have looked at more efforts going into the factors that we think cause health disparities. And we've also seen some successes in reducing health disparities.
So you feel like things are trending in the right direction and there is at least some progress being made.
There is some progress being made. I think when anyone gets to my age, they would like to move things a little faster so they can see it.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
But
As you pointed out, it's a long-standing and very intransigent problem.
Absolutely. It is. It is. And I think that we're moving in the right direction, but I think that in order for that to happen, more and more young people, more and more people who are actually concerned about this issue do more to understand exactly what the etiologic factors are on the one hand and be willing to take more action to move the agenda in that direction. Those are the things that I think that are really important today.
I see. Sure. I watched your keynote speech to the American Public Health Association annual meeting last year, and you had some very interesting things to say in that speech. And one that I'd like to kind of focus on and have you get you to elaborate on that touches on what we've been discussing. Mm-hmm. You said there is not a race problem in America. There's a racism problem in America. What does that mean?
Well, if you listen to most news reports today, people talk about race. People, when the Attorney General said Americans were afraid to talk about racism in this country, I think he was right. People are even afraid to use the word racism. Mm-hmm. The notion, unfortunately, is that the problem is some differences in phenotypic characteristic is very problematic from my point of view. And unfortunately, when people do not use the right words, when they are not focused on the correct factors that produce a problem, they will end up not solving the problem. So as long as people focus on a term like race, which in some people's minds, say minorities, for example, they might think that they're talking about racism. But what other people hear when they use that term is they're talking about differences in phenotypic characteristic. And that disconnect doesn't really get us anywhere. What we need to do is to focus on what actually causes the problem. It's racism. It is the notion that you know something about somebody based on their phenotypic characteristic and can make a judgment about that person based on those characteristics. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, among African Americans, for example, this focus on race has created this notion that African Americans cannot be, say, white supremacists. That, you know, racism is a mental illness, and melanin does not provide any immunity to this mental illness. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of issues that we do not address simply because we focus on this term race as opposed to focusing on racism. Mm-hmm. The other issue is that this is February. This is Black History Month. I am always amazed how little African Americans know about African Americans, about the history of African Americans, about the culture of African Americans, about the values and philosophy of African Americans. And this lack of understanding has been very problematic. It's been a barrier to solving some of the problems in our communities. When you look at Wake County, for example, an election of the school board was determined by less than 2,000 people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You would
with
think
a huge impact on the community.
It has had a huge impact on the community. So that what you had is a situation where one conservative gentleman was able to put in a large amount of money to move this agenda that he had forward, that he gained support among a small group of very social conservatives. But by and large, what really happened was that those people who I'm assuming have a great deal of concern for their children simply did not get out and vote.
Mm-hmm. I've heard the same thing on the national scale.
Absolutely.
As to what happened in the last election, that I think it was Cornel West I saw on television. He said the reason the Republicans all got elected was we didn't get out there.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so focusing on African Americans, for example, as an ethnic group with ethnic issues and concerns and a positive feeling about their culture, history, values, and so on, could move this agenda forward as opposed to having it defined by simply phenotypic characteristic. Because when you define people by their phenotypic characteristic, they only see themselves as a skin color.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore do not react in a way that's more positive towards the community, but simply react in a way that focuses on what harm others might do to them in a negative way, as opposed to a positive way, focusing on what their community concerns are.
Absolutely. Along the same lines, Bill, another thing you said in that same speech to the American Public Health Association, you also said that to solve health disparities, we must also study racism.
Yes.
Now, again, that's along the same lines of what we've been discussing, but I'd like you to elaborate on that statement. How will studying racism help to solve health disparities?
Yes. Well, I think it's very important to understand what brings people to these kinds of positions, because the language is so unclear now. Right now, we are talking a lot about the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm.
Confederates would say that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery, that it was about states' rights. But then you have to ask, what was the state right that they were most concerned about?
Right.
And it was slavery.
Indeed.
You know, segregationists will tell you that they are concerned about busing.
Mm-hmm.
But segregationists love busing when it supported segregation. They hate busing when it supports integration.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we get this language that's confused. And people, therefore, do not focus on how to solve the problems. So what I think a clarity of understanding of the problem is really important for us to even start the conversation on the issue of health disparities and other social disparities.
What about the current atmosphere, Bill, in terms of, you know, all we're hearing about right now is budget cutting and government shutdowns and threat of that and, you know, slashing budgets, quite drastically, potentially.
Right.
How does that potentially affect all of this?
Right. Well, first of all, it's the same communication issue. The issue, people talk about cutting the budgets, but that's not really what they're talking about. That because you could solve all the problems of the budget by simply cutting the Defense Department in half.
Mm-hmm.
Simple thing to do. The issue is cutting social programs. People will say that they're talking about the budget when really they're talking about cutting programs that would allow people protections in terms of health, protections in terms of economic dissolution. Those are the things that the real focus is about. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, when we are able to misuse language, it could misdirect people into thinking that one issue is important when it's not. Let me talk about a very touchy issue. People talk about abortion as if the issue is abortion. Well, that's really not the issue that people talk about. What people actually talk about is whether one person has a right to stop another person from doing something that they consider morally wrong. Do I have a right to stop you from smoking a cigarette when I think it's morally wrong? I don't think I have that right. That there are many people who believe that they have a right to dictate to other people what they should and should not do. Mm-hmm. I come from a very conservative religious background, but I do not believe I have the right to force people to live the simple life committed to truth that I believe I have a responsibility to live.
I see. Well, continuing on with it seems like the agenda that is really at work right now is to disassemble the social safety net.
Absolutely.
And that's, you don't hear that addressed very often.
Right.
There's a haze of numbers and there's a lot of miscommunication and a lot of misdirection.
Yes.
Good magicians up there.
Absolutely.
do you think that there is a root of racism involved with all of this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm trained as a statistician, and one of the things that people say is statistics lie. Statistics don't lie. Politicians lie about statistics.
Don't they, though?
You know, for example, one of the misdirections about the current issue in Wisconsin is that public employees, on the average, make more money than private employees. But what they don't say is that for a given level of education, public employees make a lot less money than private employers.
Sure.
That a person who worked as a physician, epidemiologist at a place like Centers for Disease Control make about 50% about what they would make if they were out in private practice.
Mm-hmm.
So the real commitment for many public servants, people who've had that experience like myself, we're driven by the commitment to serve the country, the entire country. That is why many public employees are willing to sacrifice pay in order to, in quotes, do good work.
Sure.
But to suggest that public employees are actually making more than private employees for the same level of education and technical abilities is just a gross distortion of the data.
Absolutely, and no surprise there.
Right.
It's one of many gross distortions that those people are espousing, and I was seeing something just last night that I found pretty interesting. North Carolina has one of the, I think, seven largest budget deficit problems, and here we are in a right-to-work state.
Mm-hmm.
No collective bargaining
exactly.
For public employees.
Right, because the issue is really not about the budget per se. It is about trying to change a social agenda in this country, which was moving towards caring about people who were less fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think about sometimes is fascinating is what would happen if a 33-year-old Jewish man were to walk into a conservative Christian church with 12 of his friends talking about peace, love, and concern about the poor.
They'd be calling security.
Exactly. So I think, what mm-hmm. people say that they are talking about and what people are actually talking about, unfortunately, has grown a great distance. And let me, in terms of studying racism, if I could.
Please.
I think it is important to study those people who identify as Tea Party participants. We can learn how they think about other Americans. If we are to look at what they say and the placards that they have, these are people who say they love America, they just hate Americans.
Right.
You know, you know, what is the thinking? How does someone come up with that kind of reference?
And they want to take their country back.
Yes.
From what?
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we really need to understand what is the thinking. If you look at issues of racism in many countries around the world, what you'll find is that there will be between 15 and 20% of the population who have some perception of superiority to other members of their communities. It seems to be consistent across a number of nations. And who are these people? How do they come to this thinking? What motivates them to think like that? And more importantly, how can we help them to see that they benefit from having a more positive view of other members of their community? White Southerners who were segregationists in the 1950s and who were poor actually benefited from the civil rights movement, perhaps as more or as much as African Americans. But they didn't see that then. And so how do we communicate with individuals to allow them to appreciate everyone in our nation, as opposed to just focusing with some disdain on some members of our communities?
Yeah, it's certainly a topic for much continued study, as you say. My guest on Radio in Vivo today is Dr. Bill Jenkins, and he is co-director of the Minority Health Project at the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. Bill, I'd like to spend much of our remaining time together on the program learning more about your very prolific past accomplishments, because there's a lot to talk about there also. To start, why don't you kind of give us an overview of your years at the CDC? I know that much of your work centered around sexually transmitted diseases, or sexually transmitted infections as they're known now, particularly prevention of STDs and HIV in the minority community itself. Tell us a little bit more about your experiences.
Well, I first started out as a biostatistician, but after only a few years at CDC, I got an opportunity to and be involved in more management activities. And it was the first effort to develop minority students in the field of biostatistics. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I got involved, a physician in the center in which I worked was concerned about a study in Alabama on black men who had syphilis. And I didn't understand completely what his concern was, because I think we're all trained in science. We think, you know, these kinds of studies are important, you know, and people really don't understand what we need to do in order to understand these relationships in health. Mm-hmm. But I knew that this person was very uncomfortable with me, because I had a reputation of being, you know, sort of militant and stuff like that.
Okay.
And I ran a so-called underground newspaper called The Drum at the same time. And so what I realized is that this was something he was deeply concerned about. And after some months of reading and talking to people and so on, came to the conclusion that this was unethical and we had to do something about it.
And this was the Tuskegee study.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so that experience led me to, number one, wanting to move away from management and go back to school. So I did that for a number of years and then came back to CDC and got involved in the STD division, having been recruited by one of my professors.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Immediately, again, had the opportunity to supervise the people who actually carried out that study. And what you find out is you want to believe that they're, you know, sort of evil people and good people. It's never that clear.
Sure.
These people cared about the men in the study. They knew their birthdays. They knew them personally and, you know, kind of.
Mm-hmm. And these were almost 400 sharecroppers, right?
Yes, initially. Okay. Well, mm-hmm. 600 initially, 300 positive, 300 negative. Yeah.
Okay, I see.
And so, again, it was in understanding how these things occur that led me back into management and back into trying to figure out how do we move an agenda forward that allow people to think not only about the research, but about the people we're doing research on or with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I went to a meeting to talk about a few cases of Kaposi sarcoma that we'd seen on the West Coast. And we had never seen that in young men before. The result was to start studying on something called GRID, gay-related disease, which ended up being AIDS and then ended up being HIV disease.
Sure.
With the discovery of the virus by the French Pasteur Institute.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave an opportunity now to look at a disease, how it spread, and how we might involve the community in trying to stop that spread from occurring. But what it also led to is a observation about how leadership in communities can actually do great harm. In the HIV epidemic, the reluctance for African American leaders to take on the issue was enormous. I am sure that people like Minister Louis Farrakhan or Mr. Dick Gregory probably meant well, but they did enormous harm in terms of allowing the community not to address this issue of HIV earlier on when we had the ability to really control it, to really prevent it from being spread. So what I'm saying is that there are two parallel things. One is to do research on diseases and the issues that cause health disparities in those diseases, but becoming more and more aware of the political impact of actions which can actually result in the spread of disease. And then combining that to look at health disparities more specifically, mm-hmm. and how we might do something about reducing these disparities.
Well, as an epidemiologist and a biostatistician, I have to ask you, how do you go about quantifying those kinds of things?
Well, actually, in one level, it is very simple. In epidemiology, we study basically two rates, incidence and prevalence, new cases that occur in communities and the risk of acquiring disease, and prevalence, the magnitude of disease in a community. We look at these rates in two ways, by their differences and by their ratio. People make very complicated, long mathematical discussions about concepts that are by and large relatively simple to understand. When we make decisions about just about anything, we really make comparisons in only two ways, by subtraction and division. And, you know, it's that simple.
Mm-hmm.
We can make it far more complicated in our efforts to make it more precise, but fundamentally that's it. And so we're even able to combine this concept of differences by subtracting the differences and dividing by the denominator, but I won't go into that. The basic point is that the idea of measuring health disparities at one level is very simple. It is looking at the differences and trying to figure out what causes those differences.
Mm-hmm.
We have developed all kinds of methodologies that are very sophisticated. But for the average person, the analysis is very simple.
Subtraction and division.
Exactly.
Got it. Well, you know, it's interesting that we've kind of delved into this area because HIV/AIDS in the African-American community is still a tremendous problem.
Absolutely.
And a growing problem.
Right.
Even in the face of, you know, I guess worldwide, it's starting to be better controlled. You talked about leadership having some issues there. What are some other reasons that you might ascribe that to?
Right. Well, I think, you know, first of all, whenever a new disease comes about, people get so wrapped up into the disease, they forget about the people who are acquiring the disease.
Mm-hmm.
Very early on in the epidemic, in two communities relatively close to each other in southern Florida, there was one case of a young lady who appeared to have contracted AIDS from her dentist, who apparently infected her. A few miles up the road from that, in Belgrade, Florida, it was the first community outbreak of HIV disease in which it was spread through drug use and prostitution in that community. It was an almost all black community.
Mm-hmm.
The effort to look at Belgrade would have provided us with much of our understanding about how this disease spread and what we could do. However, news reporters were far more interested in this one case, because she was a beauty queen and blonde and so on,
right,
than they were in the problem that would have helped us to understand as a nation what we were dealing with. So, unfortunately, what people, what media and common people, not common, but people, general public, tend to either focus on or be focused on are not the things that actually would help us to solve problems. They're the things that might entertain us. They're things that might make us, you know, concerned or interested in one individual in one case, particularly if it's someone we could admire or so on.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of solving these problems, it is far more complicated. People tend to avoid looking at, unfortunately.
Which I'm sure much of that harkens back to poverty.
Yes.
Racism.
Yes.
Other forms of discrimination.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. Because this was a poor community. Belgrade was a poor community of cane cutters who fell on hard times, became a place where prostitution was prevalent, and so on, the disease was spread, and so on. So, yes, socioeconomic status is a substantial factor in health disparities and what happens, and a big issue in terms of politics.
Absolutely. Bill, I'd like to bring you back to the Tuskegee study and talk about that just a little bit more, because I'm quite fascinated by the history of that, which in researching for our discussion today, I returned to some of your material about that and learned some things that I was familiar with, you know, because it is a quite notorious case, and I had to study it as becoming a member of the UNC IRB, and they teach you all that.
Yes, they do.
Which is good.
Yes.
But I still learned some things I didn't know. And you kind of held that up as an original model for community-based participatory research, which is so much in vogue today.
Yes.
How did something that had, you know, as you said, some very positive aspects go so horribly wrong?
Yeah, absolutely.
And we should, I guess, talk about, give a little bit more of the facts of the case just for people who aren't familiar with it.
Okay. Well, in 1895, one of the most important speeches in Black American history was delivered in Atlanta by Booker T. Washington. It was named the Atlanta Compromise, where Booker T. Washington said essentially he would accept segregation on the one hand, with support from European Americans who would help him with what he called the Tuskegee Experiment. The Tuskegee Experiment was an economic development program that focused on African Americans lifting themselves up through their own efforts, but receiving support resources from the larger community. And one of the things that horrifies me sometimes is that this incredible activity, the Tuskegee Experiment, in which you had models for public education developed, the agricultural research program with essentially saved the agricultural system of the South, architectural programs, medical programs. It was absolutely an incredible effort that essentially created the infrastructure which still exists here in the United States.
So it was quite progressive in its day.
It was very progressive, and it involved the communities in all of those activities. But because one assistant editor decided to, rather than use the term the Tuskegee Study of Untreated Syphilis in the Negro Male, decided to name a book the Tuskegee Experiment, all of that history was lost. Most African Americans do not know what huge contribution the Tuskegee Experiment made. The only thing that they are told repeatedly is that the Tuskegee Study was a Tuskegee Experiment, which just spreads incredible ignorance in the community about what actually happened. And it is so, so unfortunate that something that started out so good could end up in such disaster. Now, getting to the Tuskegee study itself, in Macon County, Alabama, where the study occurred, the prevalence of syphilis in that county after young men returned from World War I was more than 25%. Very prevalent disease. There was no cure for syphilis.
Right.
And it was itself a very fascinating disease, but I won't go into that.
And this was pre-penicillin.
Absolutely. The treatment for syphilis at that time included mercury, arsenic, and bismuth.
Oh, great.
So mercury and arsenic are probably elements you might not want to take.
Indeed.
Or you would want to take them extraordinarily carefully. And so it required medical training. Macon County, Alabama, had one of the few owned and managed black hospital, John Andrews Hospital, and that's why the community was chosen to do this work. The notion that it was chosen because it was this poor, backward community is just the opposite of what really happened. And even among small farmers in Macon County, Alabama, many of them own their own land. The reason the Tuskegee Institute was able to develop in Macon County was because African Americans owned their own land and they could vote.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, mm-hmm. a political compromise was reached to start the school in Tuskegee and to recruit a young man from Hampton named Booker T. Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Most people in Tuskegee today probably can tell you actually started Tuskegee, which is, again, this whole thing about not knowing history, not knowing how things actually occurred.
Right.
And anyway, they recruited 600 men into this study. Because syphilis had been so prevalent, and they were trying to actually treat syphilis initially. And then in 1929, they ran out of money, similar to what we're going through here in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And the result was they decided, rather than treat the men, which was very expensive, to follow them for a certain period to see if what happens when they have syphilis. Unfortunately, when papers began being written about the impact of syphilis, they decided that what they would do would follow them another year or so, then another 10 years without treating them.
Mm-hmm. And this was after penicillin had...
Well, after the 15th year or so, penicillin was developed.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And right around World War II, penicillin was developed. It was discovered in 1936, but only an effective treatment that was readily available to the public in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
And these men were denied penicillin. They were actually kept out of the military in order not to be treated, some of them.
Right.
And then by 1947, rapid treatment centers were established for almost every county in the United States, and these men were still denied treatment. And that went on eventually for 40 years, denying these men treatment. Actually, activities were undertaken to ensure that they didn't get treated.
That's just unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
It really
unbelievable.
But and it went all the way to 1972.
Absolutely.
It finally got halted.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And some of us had started in 1969 to try to do something about ending the study.
Mm-hmm.
But we were not all that successful. It was Peter Buxton, who's now alive and well in California, who was able to get that first article published. And then once that article was published about the study, those of us who had been working on trying to end the study, people began to listen to us,
sure.
you know. And then Senator Ted Kennedy was the person who called for an end of the study, called for hearings on the study, and called for health benefits being provided to survivors of the study.
Mm-hmm.
And Attorney Fred Gray filed a suit in Alabama to solidify that initial call for redress against what happened to the men in the study.
And you were personally involved with the long-term follow-up, I take it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I was asked to take responsibility for the program which took care of the health and well-being of the men who were in the study, both those who were positive for syphilis and those who were not. And I did that job for a number of years.
That must have been very rewarding work.
It was. Initially, I have to admit that I took on that responsibility because I felt disappointed that I was not able to end it in 1969. But in the final analysis, it was a real gift because in working with these men, I learned that there was a point in history when black men had grace, that they were concerned about their community, that they worked in their churches, that they took care of their families, that they, you know, took care of their children and other children in the community, that these were gentle, kind, caring men. That was important for me to relearn
mm-hmm.
because in the world of the 1960s and the 1970s, and particularly today, you get this sense that black men are outrageous and criminal almost, that, you know, rude, vulgar. It was wonderful to have the experience of realizing that there are many black men, even today, who have this grace, who have this concern and kindness and caring, because what we almost only hear about in the media is those who are vulgar and violent.
Well, you are certainly a role model for exactly what you've just been describing.
I hope I'm a mentor for that activity. Yes.
Well, and speaking of mentoring, briefly, because we're about to run out of time here, I did want to ask you about your role in mentoring and in trying to increase diversity within your field.
Yes, yes. Well, we've our institute has been training minorities for the last 25 years. We've trained about 500 students. I don't use the word role model because I'm not sure the role models really make very much impact.
Mm-hmm.
What we need are people to mentor individually people who come behind them.
Sure.
And so much of my time is spent talking with people who are interested in following us in these activities and spending time talking about how they may best do much better job than I was able to do to move this agenda forward.
Absolutely. Well, Bill, it has been a real honor and a great pleasure to have you on Radio en Vivo today.
Thank you so much.
And as usual, I have a bunch of questions we never had a chance to do, so we'll have to do it again.
Okay.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio en Vivo. You can check the website, radioenvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows, which is updated as we book new appearances. And we are on Facebook, so we invite you to become a fan and stay up to date. So join us again next time for Radio en Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carborough and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy this program and the others on WCOM, we ask that you please make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. And one great way to do that is to log on to the WCOM website, WCOMFM.org, click on the Donate Now button, and get the details on how to make a small monthly contribution and join our Less Than a Latte Club. For less than the cost of just one latte per week, you can help keep this independent voice of the community on the air. We appreciate your support. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time.